The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
New research says that it takes just 35 minutes for a child to become hooked on TikTok. And calls have been made for regulations and algorithms and content, particularly for young users whose cognitive development is easily disrupted. Talk to me more about this. I'm joined by Alwyn Moran, who is founder of Cogni Kids and neurodevelopment therapist, and Richard Hogan, author of Home is Where the Start Is and columnist with the Irish Examiner. Alwyn, can I pick up on that thing of the cognitive development? Is that it has a psychological impact or that it has a literal neurological impact?
It has neurological impact. Yes, it absolutely does. There's more and more research now coming out about the actual structural changes that are taking place in the brain, depending on the amount of screen time and the type of content that is being consumed while the child is on a screen.
And what does the research reveal?
Shockingly, actually, there's thinning of the outer cortex. You normally see this in the aging brain. So the question is, are they not actually developing that nice, big, juicy brain that we need? Because we know that movement, actually, we need movement. Physical movement actually helps to create a really big, juicy brain. It helps to secrete a thing called BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And that helps your brain actually physically grow. So when you think about kind of screen time, look at seeing what does it remove from our children. And it does remove movement and social, like real life in social, in real life social connection. And they're the two things that help to really build a good, solid, resilient brain, which is what we really need to
see.
And
what age groups does that most affect?
It's actually kind of, it depends on at what point the phone or the screen or the content, you know, is introduced. And then it doesn't really get any better. So there is a ton of research around the earlier that a child gets a phone, say, let's say if a child gets a phone at around the age of 8, by 13, their academic performance is lower than their peers who did not have a phone at the age of 8. Yeah.
Now, does that factor for things like demographics and which cohorts are likely to get a phone first?
Yes. Yeah, so we do know that cohorts in lower socioeconomic groups are more inclined to get access to a phone and to social media at a much earlier age, almost twice the amount as those in, say, a non-DESH area or a non-lower income kind of household. But the key thing and the impact around the cognitive side of things is the fact that it impacts, you know, your focus, attention, working memory, emotional resilience. It knocks on into the sleep, increases cortisol. You know, this brain is so vulnerable to basically being online at an early age.
What was your reaction then to the analysis that says that it takes as little as 35 minutes for an addiction to form in a child that is exposed to something like TikTok?
We do know it. TikTok is designed specifically, it literally is designed to be addictive. And our children are powerless, really, because their brains are so immature and non-developed. Like our prefrontal cortex doesn't develop fully until 23 to 25 years of age. And that is the part of the brain that helps us put the brakes on our impulsive behavior. It helps us kind of look at things from a 360 so that we kind of, you know, we're rational thinking. And none of that is in play, particularly if we're thinking about a preteen, a tween, or an early teen getting a phone. Very, very vulnerable stages of their lives, you know.
Let me bring in Dr. Richard Hogan as well. Richard, the addictivity of it, what is it about it, both neurologically and psychologically, that makes it so addictive?
Yeah, hi Anton. Everything Alwyn said there is absolutely spot on. I suppose the question we're asking, is TikTok killing your brain one short video format at a time? And the research would say, yeah, you know, the research is pointing to, yeah. It's the short format, Kieran, Anton. It's that short format that activates the reward center of the brain. The next video will be better. The next one will be better. The next one will be better. That's where the real problem is. And I think what we have currently is a generation of teenagers it's like an epidemic where they can't handle boredom. Mm. They can't concentrate. They cannot sit down and watch a movie. Everything has to be abbreviated. Everything has to be instantaneous. Think about that, Anton, as information. Do we consume all, you know, they're getting exactly the information they want to consume all the time. And so that is massively disruptive in their cognition and their development of themselves and their maturation and moving through life. But they don't actually develop skills of, like, you know, those really important skills of small talk, meeting people, not having a device, chatting. They're not doing that, you know. And I work in schools and I see when their friend is out and their friend is sick, they don't go into school because they don't want to make that small talk. So all of these things are increasing anxiety about themselves and the world, their ability to meet people and to, you know, to represent themselves well in society. So all of that stuff has been depleted. It's really sad, Anton, but we know this for a long time. You know, TikTok's been here for 9 years. We don't have massive comprehensive longitudinal studies in it, but anybody working clinically would see this and hear it represented in their clinic, talking with teenagers. And the big thing they say to me, Anton, I'm talking to them every day of the week, they say, I wish I didn't get the phone so early because I cannot concentrate.
Now, what are the argument, Richard, that someone will make that says, look, that is going to be their adult life. They are going to have to deal with information coming at them in that format. So it's better that you give them guided access to it rather than keep it away from them until their late teens and then dump them into what will be the real environment they live in the rest of their lives.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think we need to have far better digital literacy in our primary schools and in our secondary schools. We need that as a matter of urgency from our government. But we do need robust legislation around this, because that argument, you know, this is the world and this is how they're going to be consuming information. But a lot of the information that they consume is quite damaging and deleterious to their psychology and their development. And so, you know, things like pornography and all that, we do need legislation around that to protect that content from getting to them. Yes, we need to introduce them to technology, but we have to do it in a way that shows them, you know, what are the goods, the ills, and the, you know, and what is good about the stuff. Technology of itself isn't an ill. This is the way we're moving forward with our lives. This is, you know, AI is coming in next. All of that's, you know, can help us to work more efficiently, and all of those things really benefits to all that. But we have to have good digital literacy in schools so that our children understand about in perpetuity. They understand about images. They understand about scrolling. The guy who invented, you know, infinite scrolling actually regrets it, Antoine, because he knows.
I mean, honestly, they have so much data around our children, and it is absolutely, it's an abuse almost of power, because they know what they like, they know how often they're on, they know what things, you know, interests them. And actually the TikTok algorithm, if you happen to click on something on a suggested page, or, you know, you're just being inquisitive, if you click on something, within 5 days, your content on that topic will have increased by 80 to 120%. So they're pushing content continuously, which means then, as Richard said there, it's that short form. It's like a slot machine, because they hang on and they're like, oh, what's the next one going to be? What's the next one? So the brain loves that novelty and that uncertainty. And it'll just, like, it's literally designed to keep them doing that. So without a doubt, they should be much more regulated. They absolutely should be. But we also, as parents, cannot rely solely on these tech giants. We know we can't trust them. They literally have not shown us that we can trust them. They haven't given us anything. They won't even release data. They'll fight people in court, you know, and they'll find a way out of it. And they've infinite pockets of cash. So I always say to parents, if the platform is free, you are the product. They are selling you. They're selling your attention. They're selling, you know, kind of like, our kids don't know the difference when they're being sold to. They watch these unboxing things and, you know, influencers and using a cream or whatever. They don't understand that that's actually marketing. So they're really tapped into this neuromarketing that our kids are just not aware of.
So what guidance do you give to parents then? What's the best way for them to navigate that, particularly with small children?
Well, on things like TikTok, platforms like that, I really would suggest keeping them off it for as long as possible. The important thing is to resist as a parent when your child comes to you and says, but everybody is on it. I'm left out. Kids are naturally wired to be like that. As Richard said, it's social validation. They all want to do the same thing. However, what's really critical at this point is highlighting the importance of being an independent thinker. and building resilience in your own child about how to deal with not doing the same thing as everybody, because not necessarily just because everybody is doing it doesn't actually mean it's the right thing to do. So we've got to tap back into that in our parenting and be strong in that. But definitely, you know, meet them where they are. You need to know what TikTok is doing. You need to be on there. You need to have a look, go on their account, have parental controls in place. But of course, we can't rely on those because kids are fantastic and they probably know better ways around parental control than we do, you know.
Text saying parenting. Let's blame TikTok or Insta for child behavioral problems, but let's not talk about the elephant in the room, the parents that give the child the tools and the social media. Another, what about 2 or 3 year olds on screens, which is relatively common. You see it often.
They now have a thing called TikTok ticks, where they've seen toddlers when they're sleeping and their body is physically mimicking the scrolling actions. So, I mean, that is horrifying, absolutely horrifying. And it is 100% down to how much screen time a 2 and 3 year old is on. And they shouldn't actually, by the way, be on any screen time. The only thing a young child should be on is if they're doing something like a Zoom with a loved one. But they really, now it's different to TV, but like handheld devices and things like that with the short form content flying.
Richard, anything you'd add on parental advice?
Look, Anton, we cannot outsource our parenting to these devices. Yeah. I've been saying that for 15 years. We cannot outsource our parenting. We have to get that agency back. We have made the biggest miscalculation ever by saying they're safe and they're up in a benign activity there in the room, and then we don't let them out. We have to let them out and get them off their screens. Yeah. And we have to have check your history, bring in things like custodial, look at what's happening on your daughter's phone there or your son's phone, be present in their life. The research which suggests the more you're present, the less likely they get involved in risky behavior and the less likely that a perpetrator comes into their screen to them. So just get your hands around it. It's not beyond us, Anton. We do need our government to have legislation and regulate this whole thing, but as parents, we can't expect the government to parent our children. We have to bring in nice little rules in the house. The one thing I'd say to parents, Anton, that's so important, the one thing we all can do is give our kids a better night's sleep. And that's such an important thing. Get the device out of the bedroom, give them respite during the day from it, from 5 to 7, no devices. And just bring in some sensible rules, allow them to live with it, allow it to be a part of their lives, but just have some common sense as parents around this thing. We don't outsource our parenting to it. We shouldn't be scared of it. Mm-hmm. We can upskill ourselves to understand what this thing is and how to parent it, and we'll all have a bit of a better life there.
Richard, thank you very much. Likewise, thank you to Alwyn, Alwyn Moore, neurological development therapist, and Dr. Richard Hogan, author of Where Home Is Where the Start Is and columnist with the Irish Examiner.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.
We're going to stay on tech and tech communication because a lot of people may not use emojis on the grounds that they think them to be childish. Well, researchers at the University of Texas have carried out a study and have found that emojis can improve relationships. Josh Crosby has been asking people what their favourite emojis are.
The odd time, just the basic ones, usually the crying, laughing. I use them now and again, yeah, not overly, but yeah, they're handy on occasion.
If you saw someone using the thumbs up, would you view them that it was different from an older person, or would your own friends your own age?
I would like to react to messages maybe, but like not in the message itself.
Ones for the football club probably.
Yeah, like what?
Just black and white love heart. Oh. That'd be the ones I use the most, I'd say. And laughing faces, everybody just uses a laughing face.
Probably, you know, the nice smiley one to soften the mean things I say at times.
Okay, so just like a subtle sarcastic in a way.
Yeah, lighten it.
Can you tell if someone is like of maybe an older age for certain what ones?
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if you watched the TV show Adolescence, but my granny now questions everything. Like she, a purple heart emoji came through from her 60-year-old friend and she was like, oh my god. So yeah,
don't really use them. Nah, wouldn't judge someone that used them, just depending on like what they're actually saying as well. If it goes along with the conversation, then
and would you have used them more so before and you've kind of given up on them?
If I see like a good story, like I'll put a couple of emojis, like laughing emojis, but that's about it.
Probably the dead skull emoji.
And what would be the meaning behind that, or where would you add it at the end of a text?
Like if someone says something like funny, you'd be like, you react like the dead skull emoji, you'd react like you're dying laughing or something.
And would there be any ones you'd maybe judge a person on, or would be viewed as a bit pathetic or sad? Or
people, like especially the youth, like around, they'd like think that the monkey filter would be like a bit old.
So if you send the monkey home closing the eyes, that's coming from an older person.
Yeah.
Right, I'm guilty of that one.
Sorry, yeah.
Well, there you go. People talking to Josh Crosby about their favourite emojis. We'll be coming back to that a little bit later on the show and explaining how it is that the correct emoji can improve your relationship. Now, yesterday, if you remember, we were speaking to Minister for Enterprise, Peter Burke, and he was outlining that one of the areas that the government is focusing on more than all others in terms of FDI, or among the top that they're focusing on, is infrastructure, specifically the national grid and improvements to the national grid so that there is better connectivity for companies that want to open up in Ireland. That upgrade to the grid is going to cost somewhere in the region, we are told, of about 19 billion euro. That's according to an investment plan published by the Commission for the Regulation of Utilities. Myrne Lynch is with us. She's Senior Research Officer with the Economic and Social Research Institute. Myrne, 18 billion is some chunk of change. Have they broken down where it's going to be spent?
Yeah, so this is part of essentially the network operators, which is ESB Networks and Airgrid. What they do is they say what the investment needs they think are, but then the regulator actually approves what they can and can't spend. And it's part of a kind of an ongoing process. So there's nothing particularly unusual about this. What is unusual is the amount of spend. But there's a couple of reasons why it's so high this time around. So first of all, we have some historical legacy underinvestment in the grid. Storm Eowyn actually showed how vulnerable our grid can be to various things. Then we also have upcoming for investing in offshore wind energy. So that's new. Usually, we're going to have to essentially build an offshore grid from scratch for the first time. And then there's also the fact that some of the wind that we already have on the system is what we call curtailed. So the wind is blowing, there's power being produced, but we can't get it to our cities and our towns. We can't get it to our homes and our businesses because there's not enough capacity on the grid. So that wind energy at the moment is essentially wasted, and instead we have to burn a fossil fuel or something like that, which costs even more money. So those are kind of the main categories, and they're kind of why it's such a chunk of change this time around.
So if that's where the money is going, the other question then is where it's coming from. When we spoke to the minister yesterday, this is some of what he had to say on that side of things.
Focus on grid. Energy is chief among those. Obviously, housing is the biggest challenge of our generation for our population. But when I meet foreign direct companies that are investing heavily in Ireland, energy always comes up consistently, meeting after meeting.
So the foreign direct investment companies want it, but they're not going to be the ones who actually pay for it. Does this end up going on the consumer's bill, Myrne?
Well, it is paid for ultimately by the consumer, but energy or large tech companies are also consumers. Now, it's up to the regulator how they recoup all of these fixed costs from the supply companies. But then it's up to your supply company how they pass that cost on to you. So it's not the case that all energy users are treated equally. There are different categories. There's really large users. There's kind of commercial users. There's residential users. And they all get their they all get the costs of the grid levied on them in different ways. So certainly nobody would want the residential consumers to bear any extra costs being imposed by the tech sector or anything like that. And there are ways to make sure that that doesn't happen. But I think even if you took all of these tech companies and these pharma companies and these data centers out of the question, there's still an awful lot of investment needed in the grid purely to keep power coming to our homes and our businesses. So there would still be large investment required either way.
What about our capacity to deploy that capital effectively? Because anytime any form of infrastructure is talked about these days, the sense is that it will take forever to build and it'll cost three times the initial estimate.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. It's a problem across the board for large infrastructure. It's a problem for housing. In terms of energy, we've been trying to build what's called the North-South Interconnector for well over a decade. It's a critical piece of infrastructure. It'll help with security north and south of the border. It'll lower emissions and, most importantly, it'll lower costs. And it's been mired in delays. That's kind of the biggest one, but even small connections, small wind farms, upgrading substations, these things do seem to take way longer than they should and cost way more than they should. And also, we tend to not know in advance how much it'll even cost a lot of the time. And all of that just adds to the cost for consumers' bills. And we actually published a paper there last year where we tried to do some estimation on what are all of these delays in the planning process costing us. And what we found was that if you just take 2,000 megawatts of wind, which isn't much, we're looking to build 9,000, but if you just take 2,000 megawatts of wind and we're able to get it through the planning system faster than it's going through at the moment, that could reduce our emissions by 5 or 6% and possibly reduce prices by 10%. So these delays are not costless. They're really having an impact and consumers are feeling them in their pocket.
And when you do the analysis of what the main causes for the delays are, is it objections? Is it access to capital? What's the roadblocks?
So first of all, it takes quite a long time for the projects to get through planning. And then the objections don't really delay a project, but what can happen is if somebody challenges the planning permission, and a huge number of energy projects, whether it's generation or transmission, there are appeals brought against the planning permission, so they go to what's called judicial review. So that takes an awfully long time as well. But then there's also other kind of hoops you have to jump through. You have to get a grid connection. You might have to get a foreshore license. You have to get an awful lot of different environmental regulations signed off on for a lot of the offshore stuff. You need reports done by marine biologists. We don't have enough of them in Ireland. So there's just hoop after hoop after hoop after hoop to jump through. And this is not unique to energy. This is all large infrastructural projects. It's just becoming incredibly cumbersome to get anything over the line.
Muireann, thank you very much for your time. Muireann Lynch, Senior Research Officer with the ESRI. And we're going to be staying with large infrastructure projects, because after the break, we'll find out why Irish Water are struggling so much to keep up with demand.